And welcome this evening to the second of our talks by Rick Watts, who's a professor of New Testament at Regent College Vancouver, on this series, It's About Life, A Biblical Journey, looking at the whole biblical story and what God is up to. So most of you will have heard this morning how he addressed the topic of what is creation. Tonight the topic will be, who are we? Who are we as humans? What does it mean to be in God's image? And there was a handout available at the entrance. Hopefully you all got that. That has complete notes from this morning's session, as well as notes for the remaining three talks. So you can follow along and scribble on that and keep track. So a very warm welcome to you. We are delighted to have Rick here with us. And without further ado, let me invite Rick to come on up and address us on, and so briefly our format, Rick will talk for 90 minutes. He is quite capable of talking for 90 minutes. And then we will have a Q&A session run for 30 minutes and be done at 9 o'clock. Okay.
Thank you, mate. Good on you. This is an amazing window, isn't it? Oh. So, first of all, I apologise. The image of drinking from a fire hydrant is one I'm very familiar with and I hear a lot about, and it's true. I kind of apologise, but we had a lot to get through this morning. You'll notice there's a lot more in your notes on that opening section than we had time to cover. You'll notice there's some sections there where we talk a bit more about ancient Near Eastern literature and the way they talked about creation stories. If you have a look at that, you'll realize that Genesis 1 comes right out of that world. God knows how to speak to people in their cultural setting. He's really good at doing that, right? Which is why when the Gospels are written, they're not written in Aramaic, because God knows the people who are going to be reading it don't know Aramaic, they only know Greek. There's a little thought there about evangelism. You've got to learn to speak to people in language they understand. Otherwise, they won't get what you're talking about. But there's a real danger in doing that, because every one of those bridges has two-way traffic. Right? So you start translating the gospel into the language of the culture, and if you're not careful, the culture can come back over you across the bridge and end up changing the gospel. That's just a little thing to think about. And I think the early church wrestled with that, actually, trying to talk to Greek speakers. And there are, I think, some serious pluses and minuses about what came out of that conversation between Christianity and Hellenism. So you just have to be aware of that stuff. As we do this cultural background, I think it's absolutely critical. You have to know the culture. But the dangerous thing about that is, in that conversation, you can be shaped by the culture in ways that are inappropriate. So just going to keep that in mind, if you will. So we do talk about the ancient Near Eastern background. We say a little bit more about Egyptian temples. And what I've done tonight is pop some of that into this session. So there'll come a moment in the outline of session two, Who Are We?, where there'll be some slides you'll be thinking, hang on, where do they come from? They come from the morning session, popped in here, so you actually get some of those cookies as well, right? You're not going to miss out too much on that. In the question and answer time, it'll be open for you to pursue some issues that you'd like. Under advice from some people who are very helpful here, I think, in the first session, I'd mentioned that I know there are texts that raise questions. What about the earth burning up? What about the heavens passing away? Well, hang on. What happens to the person whom I loved, who's now no longer with us? Where are they? I'm happy to answer those questions in the question and answer session, okay? If you don't mind being Australian, I might also choose to say that's a very interesting question, but it kind of lies outside our purview. Come and talk to me later. We won't deal with that in the question and answer session. Is that all right? So I will exercise a little bit of lecturely control over the topics that we're going to address publicly. Not because I want to, you know, escape, but because I just want to keep us focused if I can. So, creation is God's temple. Just to remind you what the implications of that might be, right? We're not going to heaven. Heaven's coming here, as far as I can see scripturally. Right? And you might be thinking about John, you know, I'll come and take you and that kind of thing, but I can answer that question, the question break, if you like, at the end. Seven times God calls creation good. The implication of that is, I think any denigration of the of matter or the body is ultimately demonic. Any denigration of matter or the body is ultimately demonic. So for me, when Christians talk about just saving souls, if by soul we mean what Pythagoras means, namely some purified, very fine matter in ourselves that's going to escape our body and, you know, wing its way dove-like to heaven, if that's what we mean, we're not being Christian. Because that's not what the Hebrew word soul means. It's much more to do with, I think, Bernard can correct me, but the lifeness of who we are as individuals. Right? That stuff that makes the difference between me 5 minutes after my fatal heart attack and me 10 minutes before, right? That's the Rick thing, the Rickness, right? Duns Scotus, famous philosopher, kind of talk about this. We'll let that go, right? Christian salvation is about saving the whole of creation, right? Which includes our bodies. That's why we have a resurrection like we do. The second thing that's really important out of this, right, the idea of creation being good, and it's critical, and we can't have this conversation here, but it's stunningly exciting, is that this observation that creation is good gave us the modern world. It's not perfect, it's good. You don't want to live in a perfect world. No, you don't. Because if it's perfect, it can never change. Is that the world you want? Groundhog Day forever? Is that really what you want? Now that's Athens. Athens is about the cosmos being perfect. The Bible never talks about that. It's a good creation. One of the things that makes it good is that it's open to change, which gives you space and me space to invent stuff. In a perfect world, there's no room for change. That's what perfect means. Eternal, unchanging. That's not the world God gave us. He gave us a good one, which means you can keep working on perfecting that coffee. He gives Apple space to work on an electric car. You can keep working on those amazing technologies that are about taking care of the world, and that's just built into what this is. So you've got to hear that, right? Christians don't believe in a perfect world. That comes from Athens, that's not us. We believe in a good one. And the gift of the goodness is it's open to change, which gives you space to do something new. Right? I'll come back to this a bit later, but I think, you know, and you just, my crazy imagination, but God has a huge fridge in heaven. And it's covered with all the drawings you and I brought home from primary school, high school, and they're all up. And he says, have you seen what my kids just did? Huh? I think that's the biblical view of what God's understanding of who we are, right? Now, we know the cosmos needs to be tamed. Genesis is clear about that. Understand that. But if it's a temple, what do you know about temples? Temples are sacred places. They're holy places. And if that's true, creation is a sacred and holy place. So some people who haven't grown up in the Western tradition appreciate that better than many of us Christians do. Now, don't get scared because we don't worship it. You never worship the temple, but you recognize what it is. You only worship God. But because it's a holy and a sacred place, even as it needs taming, even as it provides timber for us, we can mine it, all those kinds of things, extract oil. We never do it in a way that treats creation with contempt. So I think this is a wonderful framework, giving humans the ability to work in the world, to make use of its resources, but never in a way that denies the fact that it's actually God's temple. And we need to be caring about how we do that. So if you want to mine, do what you can to return the environment as closely as you can to what it was. But you don't just strip mine and leave this terrible mess behind you. Right? So yep, by all means, make use of forests, but not in a way that destroys the forest entirely. Think about that, right? Be careful. I think it's a great biblical model. So, holy place, but not to be worshipped. And what Christians are on about is working with God in bringing life to His creation. So that's a bit of a summary of what I tried to say this morning. Okay? All right, good. So if you have questions about that, write them down and come back at me in the break. Very happy for you to be kind of, you know, get a bit punchy if you want to. Feel free. I can cope with that. I'm an Aussie, so we're good. Now, next big question. Some of you might have been to Egypt. This is Medinet Habu. It's the mortuary temple of one of the pharaohs. And here's Pharaoh doing his pharaoh-like thing. There's a whole bunch of Canaanites there. He's got them all by the head. And in his right hand, he's got this war mace. And guess what's going to happen next? Now remember, Pharaoh is the embodiment either of Amon-Re or his protector god Horus upon the earth. And this is the way he acts. Right? When God talks about the Exodus, what does he say? The scriptures talk about what? God making bare his mighty arm. One of Pharaoh's most common names was Lord of the Mighty Arm. And you can see it right there, right? There's his mighty arm. Laying waste his enemies. Right? And notice what's in his crown? Serpi. Right? Okay. So it raises the question then, what does it mean to be a human being? Right? If creation is a temple, what does it mean to be human? Well, if you're thinking in terms of the ancient world, it makes perfect sense to say that humans are made in the likeness and image, not of God. Now, hear me on this one. I put a line through that. Because when many of us think about God, we have this strange amalgam of ideas of who God is. We have a little bit of a nature deity in there who, when he gets upset, throws thunderbolts at us. We've got a bit of Homer's gods in there, you know, this do some odd things. They're just like, you know, Greeks on steroids. That's what the Greek gods are. We somehow that's got mixed up in our view. Some of us more intellectual, we've kind of got a God who's influenced by Plato, as though God is somehow the big original idea. We've got some Aristotle, so God is the first cause, prime mover, right? And then somewhere in there, somewhere scattered about, is this guy called Jesus, right? So I put the line through God because I want to be very specific about this. This is made in the image of Yahweh, who is a God unlike any other you have ever seen. And we'll talk about this and we say, what does it mean to be Israel? When God reveals himself, he says, I am who I am. And for me, that means, and don't guess. I am not your creation. You don't know who I am. You might think you do, and you've made images of what you think the gods are like, and they're all twisted and distorted images of yourself. That is not me. I am who I am. Look, listen, learn, mark, inwardly digest. Right? So I've made an image of Yahweh. We'll talk about who Yahweh is a bit later on, but let's focus now on the human thing, this Christian anthropology, if you like. So if creation is God's temple, what's the next question? Well, what's the last thing placed in a temple? Now, don't go Christian on me. You're living in the ancient world. You build a temple. What has to go into the temple? There it is. The image of the God. Isn't that interesting? Genesis does exactly the same thing. God builds the cosmos as his temple and puts human beings inside of it. So this slide is not on this talk, but you can hear the counter narrative. God says to people, you don't make temples for me. I made a temple for you. It's called the cosmos. You don't make an image of me. I made you in my image. That's just a radical transformation. And for people, again, who are historians of ideas, try and explain how that idea comes about out of the ancient Near East. Because it's just so counter to everything everybody believes. Where does it come from? Very interesting historical question. Maybe ask Moses. He might be able to tell you. So what does it mean then to talk about the image of God? And people have all kinds of debates about this. And you know, we kind of do the Aristotle thing. Let me unpack that just a little. One of the great things the Greeks did, and it's an amazing leap of imagination. No one else had ever done it. They basically said, what if everything in the world can be explained purely on the basis of reason? Purely on the basis of what's logical, right? It sounds like a brilliant idea. It just happens to be terribly flawed. Because you don't learn about the world by thinking great thoughts on your sun deck. You learn about the world by observing, by testing, by looking at it. Ooh, I am who I am. Don't guess. Look, learn, listen. Right back at the moment of God's self-revelation, I think, is the beginnings of modern science. Pay attention to your senses. Now, the problem with the Aristotelian thing is people discuss the image of God and they have these wonderful logical discussions up here that are completely not grounded in the culture and history of the world in which this language emerged. That's just plain dumb. Right? You've got to observe this stuff. You've got to see what's going on. You've got to pay attention to it. And I have this friend, Catherine Begeleg, as she was known back then. She did a PhD on this at Harvard University and I think had four children in the process. My goodness me. If a PhD is not hard enough to do that, astonishing. But all credit to Catherine for her work here. So what she did was she learned all these strange languages that looked like little crows walking across, you know, half-wet, you know, clay tablets, and she learned all of that stuff. And here's what she concluded. There is three steps in the ancient world to forming an image or to having images of the gods. The first thing is you form it, then you animate it, cause it to come alive, and then you install it. Right? So here's one of the few cult images we have from the ancient world. There he is looking resplendent, an Egyptian deity. We're going to talk about how this works. So first of all, the formation of the image. The first thing about an image is it has to be something you can touch. It's got to be in the round. So one of our most famous church fathers, Augustine, says, it's in our reason that humans image God. Nice try. No cigar. Next contestant, please. Right? Because he's done the Aristotelian thing and he's done, oh, this seems reasonable to me. Augustine, it's not what seems reasonable to you. It's what it actually meant back then. That's what you're after. The whole point of having an image is it's got to be present to the senses. Right? Now, it's the Hebrew Bible that is just hot to trot on the senses. Plato says you can't trust your senses. If you do, your beautiful soul is led astray because it looks at the things that are full of change. Just, you can't think of anything more opposed to the biblical pattern than that. What are you talking about? Change is God's gift. And you learn about the world by attending to it, and you do that through your senses. From the Hebrew Bible's point of view, if you can't see what's in front of your nose, it's because you're an idolater. Isn't that interesting? If you can't see what's right there in front of your senses, it's because you worship idols and they blinded you. And it might just be your idol of human reason. And it blinds you. I was talking to Bernard about this. We will get onto it. But, you know, Aristotle said, heavier things fall faster than light ones. Of course. I wish I had them up here right now. A brick and something else, right? And then I just, and you know what? For 800 years, they held the heavy thing and the light thing and no one ever thought to let them go and see what happened. Right? Now think about that. Aristotle is a really clever guy. Really clever guy. You don't realize what a radical idea it is to say, no, you've got to test your theories by what you actually see. Huh? That's Jerusalem. What does John say about Jesus? We've seen, we've touched, we've handled. Huh? Got to be in the round. Got to be something you can see and touch and handle. That's what an image is. Now, given that, right, that's what an image is about, what are you doing when you make one? And you have to see and touch, present to the senses. Well, here's a picture of, again, one of these very rare images, beautifully done. It's about 42 centimeters high. It's of the god Horus, lapis lazuli. So these things are incredibly expensive, right? That's why people want them if they can. They kind of melt them down and make use of all the expensive materials they're made of. But you can hear already, when you talk about image of God, you're talking about something immensely valuable. That's just tied up in the notion of image. They don't make trashy images. Right? And you just might want to think the implications of that through. Okay, so there's a few examples. I think that's Horus and then Amon-Ra on the right-hand side of your screen. But notice it's a pictograph. It's not a photograph. They're not trying to say that the god Horus actually looks like a falcon. That's not what they're doing. They know how to read this stuff. The fact that they've chosen to use the falcon is because the falcon communicates function and characteristics. The Bible understands this. Talking about Ephraim, right? Bull, very powerful, right? And if you know bulls, strongest animal they're aware of in their world, horns at the front and appendages at the rear, right? And that's what bulls stand for, great power and great fertility. Now, they're not saying that Ephraim walks around, they're not saying that, but they use this picture as a way of describing who Israel is, or at least Ephraim is, right? So you can see this then with, this is the Apis bull cult, very common in Egypt around about the time of the Exodus, depending when you date it. So here's the bull, and notice what the bull's wearing between its horns. There's the sun disc. Oh, and look at that. Right in front of it, there's Serpi again, right? Yeah, the repository of all the power of Egypt. And of course, what they believed is that when they dedicated this image, the creator God would stand on the back of this bull. He'd be present on the back of the bull. Now you understand why Israel builds a golden calf. Right? And they don't hold a festival to Amon-Re. They're going to hold a Hag to Yahweh. They're not after worshipping the gods of Egypt because they've seen those guys get creamed. They just want Yahweh's presence and they know how to get it. Build the bull. And why does God get so upset with him? Because he's not that kind of God. I am who I am, not this. All right, now we'll touch on that a bit tomorrow when we talk about Israel. So you go through the process then of animating the image. There's all kinds of tablets that talk about this. By the way, they'd often first begin to form the image in a sacred garden. Does that sound familiar? Right? Yeah, right. Then they'd animate it, and the animation would include a ritual opening of the eyes, the ears, right, the mouth, and animating the limbs. Right? They're actually inviting, as they do this, the fiery breath of the deity into the image. So the image actually, oh, here's an interesting question. Who do you know spend a lot of his time with? And the answer is, as in every Sunday school question, Jesus. You thought about that? Why does Jesus, he does all these amazing things, but so many of them have to do with eyes, ears, mouths, limbs, casting out unclean spirits in preparation for what? The Holy Spirit. You know where that language comes from? This is the restoration of the image of God in humanity. That's what's going on with this stuff. Phenomenal. And nobody's really thinking about this stuff. It's one of the reasons I'm convinced Jesus' mighty deeds are actually historically real. No one's thinking like this. How do you explain this idea emerging? Well, Jesus does it because that's the way he understands his miracles. But that's what they're doing, right? And then what happens is the image becomes the very presence of the God upon the earth. That's the whole point. It's about presence. You want your deity with you. And when the image has been enlivened, right, so eyes are open, so now it actually is the physical presence of the God. What do? You then enthrone the image and you place it inside its temple. All right, so here's an Egyptian temple. The little model of the universe. We talked about that this morning. We'll say a bit more about this now. But that's where you enthrone your God. So just like the God created the entire universe as his cosmic temple, what you're doing when you worship is you do that in microcosm. Right? Wouldn't it be great to think about churches and building them as models of creation? So when you walk through, the first thing you encounter is light and darkness. You suddenly move through that and now it's above and below, right? And then you move into sea and land and then, you know, and that's what brings you into the place where you worship. What an amazing idea. That's what Israel's tabernacle's like in some respects. So if you've got any brilliant architects, you might want to think about that, right? What an experience for people. Wow, I'm actually walking into this sacred temple of God that he's made and wants to be with us. Brilliant. So, yes, very good out there, right? So here's a little bit of a map of Egyptian temples. Notice at the outside, you've got these initial pools, the primordial waters out of which that, remember this morning we talked about that cosmic mountain emerging out of the reedy sea. That's what you have when you approach the temple, shallow reedy pools. You're walking through the events of the Egyptian creation story. Right? You've got that. And then the next thing you hit, those two big walls you saw, they represent the dawning of the first creation. These great, they call them pylons. Right? So here's a bit of a map and you can see them. Right? This is the great temple at Karnak. And they've got several kind of representations of this. You're actually walking through the dawn of the first creation out of these reedy ponds. Right? And you can see them here. This is at Medinet Habu. And notice as you go through, you've got the sun disk on wings. It's kind of the dawn of the first creation. Right? Now, when you hear, when God says, I'm the Son of Righteousness, risen with healing in my wings, you know what that's talking to? It's talking to this. Right? I'm the one who does all of this, not the gods of Egypt, where you've lived for 400 years. This is me who does this. Okay? Well, here's a representation. You see how it works. The ponds on either side. Here's the great entryway that takes you in. The east and western mountains are the first great horizon. They have the little obelisk because to try and build a cosmic mountain is too expensive. You can't keep building those pyramids. They just cost you a fortune. So you make a mini one that's kind of slimmed down, right? It's done that kind of health program. But you have the little cone at the top, right? And the little cone at the top represents the dawn of the first creation. Now, as you move in through that, you also had these, here are the reedy pillars. They represent, again, these reeds that emerge out of the first cosmic waters. Right? Another picture of them. And then, look at that handsome-looking chap. Oh, my goodness. How come I haven't seen him in many movies? Yeah, think about that. Every one of these pillars in Karnak has the story of creation on it. Right? So you can see what's going on here? Well, the first thing that you can notice is this is the first cosmic mountain that appears, right? And on the side of it, this is the reedy sea out of which it emerges. And that little indication, those feathers, that represents the first great creator God who materializes on the mountain. That's what their temples are telling you. This creation story over and over and over again. And then you finally install your God. And if you walk into these temples carefully, you'll notice there's a gradual rise in the floor because you're walking up the first cosmic mountain. And right in the center, in the very sacred place, is where you place your deity. You see in the background there, it's a little bit like the magic cupboard of Narnia. Right? And the idea is, of course, in the Narnia tales that as you open the door, you enter into a different world. But in these ones, the framing is on our side of the door. You see the difference? It's not like we're entering into a world, but the God enters into our world. And this is how he happens, his image being present, right, in this little inner sanctuary. Right? Now, who are you? You are now the inner sanctuary of the Holy Spirit. That's what the language means. You and I are God entering into his world. That's who your neighbors meet when you have coffee with them. They don't know it, but they're meeting you, enlivened by the Holy Spirit, reflecting the fruits and the graces of the Spirit. They're actually encountering Jesus across the back fence with a funny straw hat and the mower. Right? That's what we are. That's what we do. Right? Okay. So that's the installation of the image. There it is. Okay. Now that funny little craft in front is if the God needs to go visit his neighbors. They stick him in the craft and they take him to visit neighbors and people get to see him as he go and they goes and make, you know. It also looks a little bit like the sun bark, but we leave some of that stuff. Now, if the God is the very presence, that image is the very presence of God upon the earth. Now think about that. The image is the very presence of the God upon the earth. It really matters what you do to the image. Because what you do to the image, you're doing to the God. And here's a little picture, right? So in the morning, you come and wake up the God, you know, good morning, Amon-Re. Let me brush your hair, right? Clean your teeth, bring your breakfast, right? Amon-Re is very pleased, smells the bacon burger. Wonderful, right? Okay. Yeah, smell does matter to God, actually. No, but he does that and enjoys it. And then they bring some musicians in, you know, and doing their thing. Maybe U2 turns up doing their thing and Amon-Re enjoys that. And then the afternoon, the dancing girls come and Amon-Re's really excited about that. And And then you take him to visit his neighbours and they stand talking to one another. And you think, I mean, this is just crazy. And of course, the Bible mocks it. But you understand what they're doing is they're taking very seriously the belief that the Spirit of the God indwells that image, and that image is alive, and what you do to the image, you do to the God. Are you seeing the connections? You see why Christians are meant to do the things we're called to do to other people? You see what's underlying all of this? You see why Genesis 1 is God getting very upset with Egypt? Because Egypt has a very different narrative about who's made in the image of God. Only Pharaoh. And Israel's story is in that. Everybody. All right. So, what do we see about this in Israel's scriptures? Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it? With all this background. And of course, you understand everybody knows this, so no one needs to explain it. Now, I can guarantee it happens fairly regularly. And Bernard, you should let me know when we should take a short break so people can have a breather in the 90 minutes, because I'm just likely to keep on going till I drop, and that's not a good idea. Not for you. I mean, so just let me know, let your cell phones ring or something when you feel like, I need a break. So halfway through, if you can just do that. Do you mind? Thank you, mate. And so what often happens is people, they're a little bit upset, some people. Why haven't I heard this before? Well, it's okay. Take a chill pill. Right? God didn't have to explain it to the Israelites because everybody knew this. Right? He explained some other stuff. And, I think too, it's probably fair to say that ever since about the 3rd and 4th century, theology became more like philosophy, and philosophy doesn't really care about history. In fact, history is full of change, so it's never going to lead you to the truth. You only want the stuff that's unchanging. That's why so much of our theology looks like philosophy. Everyone's after pure, disembodied, unchanging ideas. That is why your Bible looks so different from some of the stuff you read. I know there's kind of provocative words here, but it's, some interesting things happen in the 4th century. You talked about that bridge. You start talking to another culture, it's a two-way street. So it's really only in the 17th and 18th century that people begin to take history more seriously. Because history really, yes, you had Jesus, but whoever actually really cared that Jesus was a Jew? His Jewish context is pretty much insignificant for most of the church's thinking when it's doing theology. And I'm not blaming people about that. That's the world it got into, and it started to think, well, this is the way you talk about truth. But the reason you haven't heard a lot of this stuff before, it's because the idea that history matters and culture matters and context matters is relatively new. Right? So just rejoice. Thank God that there's less hole in your donut than there used to be. And don't blame the people who went before. They were just doing what they thought was best, and be grateful for the new stuff that we've got. Is that okay? Good. So no cranky coots getting upset with someone who didn't tell you. Is that all right? It's probably not the helpful thing for us. So we have that. What's significant about this is there's an Egyptian deity where actually the image of the gods is conceived in terms of zoomorphic, so this is to do with animals, beasts, but not in the Hebrew Bible. We have a monotheistic anthropology. Sorry about that big term. Say it frequently enough and you'll speak in tongues, so that's one positive benefit from it, okay? But it's critical, right? It's because of who God is that we understand who humans are. You see, this is the huge problem of taking God out of the universe. Do that and you destroy humanity. Because we just become part of the natural world, and it's clear to me that we're not. We keep being able to create things that we're not. We have this amazing creative facility. There's something about us that is transcendent. But you can't explain that transcendence on the basis of the stuff, nature, that we transcend. So start taking God out of the equation and you're on the road that will end up destroying your vision of what it means to be human, it seems to me. So at that point, the Bible's brilliant. What's happening in Genesis 1 is humans are being freed to be who they really are. Right? The 7 days, yeah, but it's not really the issue. There are much bigger ones that are being entered into. Now, so here's that God's word to a pagan world, as we said before. You don't make a temple for me, I make one for you. You don't make an image of me, I made you in my image. Oh, and by the way, that's all humanity and not just Pharaoh. Remember, they're coming out of Egypt. Son of Amon-Re. Just imagine that scenario. There's Pharaoh with his magicians behind him, or with the little staves. Some of them have little serpents inscribed on them, little ivory wands. That's what their magical wands have. Out of the desert comes Moses and Aaron, and a declaration is made. Yahweh says, Israel is my firstborn son. Pharaoh's thinking, what the heck? You mean these people who make mud bricks for me? I mean, who the heck is Yahweh? And Aaron says, oh, really? Buddy, watch this. Down goes the staff, right? And you know the rest of the story if you're here this morning. Right? It's incredible. I just point out, by the way, that this is the first time in the Bible that God ever calls anyone son. And it's to do with Israel. The first entity called Son of God in the Bible is not Jesus. It's Israel. That might just explain why the baptism looks like it does. Water, desert, 40 days, anybody? Where have you heard that before? Right? And you won't solve that problem by thinking wonderful thoughts in your lounge chair. You have to go back and read Israel's narrative. Open your eyes, look, learn, listen, mark, inwardly digest, and you go, oh my goodness, that's what's going on. Now, this is interesting. Talked about this a little bit this morning. Who comes into the garden? Now, what happens to the serpent when it's cursed? What's the consequence? I'm not going to act it out, so it's all right. What does the serpent end up doing? Crawling on its belly. Good. What was it doing before then? Anyone been to the Valley of the Kings in Egypt? Right up in the top left-hand corner of the valley is a double tomb. In the center section of the double tomb, you will see these wall paintings. Serpents with legs being controlled by Pharaoh and his agents. Right? Such is his power over these things that are threatening to the order of Egypt. Right? And that's why he has one in his crown, kind of represents this control of the gods over these otherwise threatening forces. And you realize that's what's going on in the garden story. Right? Humanity is being tempted to be autonomous about how they acquire the knowledge about character. I think that's really what's going on. They're being encouraged to be autonomous in their learning about what character should look like. That's how I would read that, right? And instead of listening to God, they're going to do it for themselves. Welcome to our messy modern world. Now, just a little thing about this. Remember I said that the world has been, in the biblical narrative, has been gifted with radical change? The more freedom you have, you know what happens? The more central character becomes. Not virtue, not ethics, they're not Christian stuff. Virtue's from Homer, ethics is from Aristotle, that's not us. We're about the character of Yahweh, and the big things for us are trust, hope, and care. That's us, not courage, not justice per se. We've got far more than justice. God has given us love and grace, right? So we live in a world that has this incredible product of the Bible narrative, all this freedom, and what's our problem? If you've got freedom, all your design choices reflect your character. But if you don't know what it means to be human, guess what? And look at us. That's the great irony. I think the 21st century is the most Christian period in human history. With all the worldview, the way we understand knowledge, our cities, what it means to be, all that stuff is the most Christian humans have ever seen. So what's the problem? We don't know what it means to be human. Because in the biblical narrative, character stands at the very heart of it. Now, we've sometimes forgotten that in our Bible teaching. We get far more excited about how the Trinity works. wanting to have all little bits of machinery worked out, and it's all wonderful stuff, but it misses the main point. I am who I am. What's my character? That's what you're learning about. Absolutely critical to all of this. So I think that's the real temptation in the garden. Right? So, oops, I'm pressing the backward one. The red button will do that. Well, anyway, you wanted to see it again, didn't you? So, yes, of course. I think it was the leading of the Holy Spirit. Yeah, okay. So there we go. Oh, yes, look at that. Oh, my goodness, they're on legs. Woohoo! Okay, well, excellent. And notice, we've already mentioned this, it's all humanity made in God's image, not just Israel. That's remarkable. And we talked about that at least in the first session, I think, with some vigor. Racism and ethnocentricity have no place in being Christian. So if you've grown up with a view that somehow being Western is the pinnacle, or that China is the middle kingdom and it's the ultimate culture, or actually Australians are the only ones who've got it together, the right response tonight is to repent now. Because when you read those plagues against Egypt, it's telling you what God thinks about nations that have that view of themselves. Folks, and this is not trivial. You need to hear this. That attitude is demonic. Don't ever get caught up in that again. Doesn't mean that some cultures haven't learned some things better than others. But the idea that because I'm white and Western, I'm somehow superior to you, that comes from the pit of hell, actually. And I'm wearing this when I do it. Let it never be named among us. As I look out across this body of people, you have no idea how much it gladdens my heart. Look at you. You're a United Nations. Right? And who made you this? Right? A God, I am who I am. And when it comes to power, he is radically different from anybody else. I'll talk about this a bit later, but I think the glory of our God is that he lets us say no to him. This might get you thinking a little bit. But in some ways, I think the double predestination people and the Rob Bell people love wins are actually two sides of the one coin, and in the end, it's coercion. Either way, God will force you. And I think the message of the Bible is that is not what our God is like. That's what makes him different. Jesus will not force his healing upon you. He will not force resurrection life upon you. Why do you think he keeps asking people? As a blind man, what do you want from me? Oh, really? Are you serious? Right? He's not a God who forces himself upon. If you don't want eternal life, that's fine. God will not force it upon you. And you can change God's mind. Moses does. Abraham has a wonderful conversation with God. He wants us to engage with him. It's an amazing picture of the deity. Of course, if you're a Platonist and you want perfect ideas that never change, that's going to freak the pants off you. Not here, please. Right? We can do without that. But you have to ask, whose God are you actually worshiping here? Well, I know we have big debates about that, but just all humanity, not just Israel, right? So let's say a few things then. Should I take a break now and then we'll come back and look at the implications? Maybe not run around. I learned this from a friend of mine. Stand up, turn around a few times, you know, maybe sing a children's chorus. We do this kind of exercise. And, but make sure you've used the spray before you raise these up too high. Is that all right? This, okay. You want to make sure that people can actually survive this. So move around. Maybe you should get a charismatic worship band up here and kind of leave about. Yeah. Best not to leave the building because this is only 30 seconds, okay? Turn around a few times, say hello. Get the blood circulating. Good. Okay, now we're done. Please sit down. Yep. So I wasn't kidding about the 30-second break. But here we go. We're going to talk about the implications, and then it's question time from however long to the end, okay? So what does it mean to be human? Is it a blessing or a curse? Listen to the psalm. What are human beings that you are mindful of them? Mortals that you care for them? Yet you have done what? Made them a little lower than God. Right? When I was a young kid growing up, and people tried to talk about Jesus coming into the world, one of the illustrations that people used was, you know, it's a bit like you becoming an insect. You ever heard that? Right? Well, that's what I was told. You know, that this, and theologically, this is called the double humiliation. The humbling of Jesus in the incarnation and then the humbling of Jesus upon the cross. I have serious problems with that because Psalm 8 says, actually, human beings are just a little lower than God. For Jesus to become human was not a great step down, actually, because we were designed from the beginning to be his dwellings. That's what it means to be a human being. If I'm made in God's image, I am designed to be the physical manifestation of the one true God upon the earth. When I talked about you talking to your neighbor across the fence and they were actually encountering God, I was not joking. It's exactly the way God intended it to be. And when you're having a cup of tea with somebody in the local restaurant and they open their heart to you because they know you care and you listen and you bring God's grace to them, you are, at that moment, the very presence of the living God physically manifest to this other human being, even in a funny shirt, right? Maybe muscles not quite what they used to be when I was younger, but still the very presence of the living God bringing his life to people. That's an astonishing vision of being human, isn't it? How often have you heard people say things like, well, you know, I sometimes lie and cheat because I'm only human. Ever heard that? No. We do that stuff because we're less than human. To be human is to image God, and God does not lie. Every time I lie, cheat, dissemble, I am betraying my humanity. Every time I make a decision that's about taking someone else's life from them to benefit me, I am betraying my humanity. Now, this is not a movie you're going to watch on a Sunday morning, but who's ever seen, it's an old one, Magnolia with Tom Cruise. Anyone seen that? Okay, it's a pretty raw film, so, you know, you want to be careful about it. It's brilliant because it's full of these parabolic images, and the two powerful men in that movie have both treated people just like junk. And in the movie metaphors, they both end up dying of cancer. Now, my parents died of cancer, so I understand it's a difficult issue. I am not saying everyone who dies that way, it's because of. But in the movie, they've understood, use other people and it will lead to your own destruction. It will destroy your humanity. Right? Who are human beings? We are the pinnacle of God's creation. That's what we are. Now, we haven't always lived that out in a way that brings flourishing to our world, which is why many people kind of now talk about speciesism, because humans have actually not been very good in exercising that role of shepherding. Have you ever heard that speciesism stuff, that humans are just part of nature? Well, it's out there, and it's partly there because as humans, we've not lived out our role. And as Christians, I think that's what we're called to do. We're meant to model what it means to be those who are God's presence upon the earth. So you like gardening and you like tending your plants? Yeah, you are the presence of God to that rose. You are the presence of God to that magnolia. You really are. That's what you're here for. When you're tending to that stuff, when you're mowing your lawns and taking care of your garden, what's that got to do with God? Everything. Because that's what we are. We're his gardeners, taking care of his creation. Right? Washing the dishes will never be the same again. Dishes have to be washed. Someone has to do it. And the servant God has said, yep, as my image bearers, that's what you will do. You will serve those dishes by washing them and taking care of them. Right? Isn't that an interesting thought? I was talking to someone once about, when I was at Gordon Conwell, I worked as a night watchman in a factory, and he was saying, oh, that's kind of interesting, you're doing theology, doing that. And he said, so how did you think about it? I said, well, you know, I was a shepherd of the machines. Kind of looked at me and I said, yeah, machines need shepherding. They have to be taken care of. So, you know, while shepherds wash their machines by night, all seated on the ground. But that's what we do. That was my job. I did my rounds shepherding these machines, making sure they're okay, right? Didn't quite talk to them. But you know, that's what we do. You take care of your car and you look after it. That's what you're doing. You're shepherding this thing, right? You're reflecting God's care. You don't worship it because it's not God. But you know, that's your responsibility to care for stuff, right? Isn't that amazing? You're building a house. You know what you're doing? You're building a dwelling for the image of God. That's going to change the way you do your work. Right? When you're designing one, you're not just designing stuff to make money. You're actually designing something, the aim of which is to bring life to the people who will live in it. Now, can you just think for a moment what that's going to do to the way you relate to other people? When you walk in to buy your sandwiches, it's not just about the sandwiches. It's that person who's serving me is made in God's image, and my job is to bring God's life to them. So that's going to change the way you relate to people, isn't it? Right? It's wonderful. We'll say a bit more about that later. Pinnacle of God's creation, right? Yahweh's cult image. I know the word cult kind of freaks us out a bit, but it's a technical term. Cult means the way you do your worship stuff. That's what we are, right? Now, you know some churches that have images of Mary or someone like that in them, okay, but actually from God's point of view, each one of us are his living, breathing, walking image in his building, in his creation, not just here, but the whole place. God gave us our senses. This is absolutely critical. Exodus 4 talks about this, right? And the senses play a massive role in Israel's scriptures. I just read a book on this. There are scores of references to do with the fact that we can see and hear. That's what God wants us to do. That's how we engage with the world. That's how we actually function as God's image. Our senses engaging. Brilliant. So what's our job then? To do the work of and to safeguard the Edenic garden sanctuary. Right, that's the whole thing of seeing the earth as God's holy of holies, and that's what we do. We work as his priests in this place, doing its work, safeguarding it. So what does this mean for our world? Okay, well, here we go. Being human then, well, I'm only human. No, we've talked about that. No, we're not just only human. We're actually a little lower than God. All right, so can I suggest you'll never be so spiritual as when you're truly human? In my tradition, being human was the problem, and you tried to be spiritual, and you just became odd. Right? But what do you love about Jesus? I mean, he's just so comfortable in his skin, isn't he? Right? He just knows how to relate to people. So yeah, they're right. Christianity is the true humanism for every human being. Right? Discovering what it means to be human. That's what we're after. It's not our humanity that's the problem. It's the fact that we're less than human. And what God's about is restoring this. And I'm sure you've heard some of this stuff before, right? So what does it mean to image Yahweh? Well, first of all, his character. All the stuff that reflects God's character, this is what we're meant to do. His justice, his righteousness, his mercy, and his grace, all of those things are reflected in him. We'll talk about this a bit more tomorrow. There is a point where the I am who I am gets a predicate, and it's astonishing. You know, I mean, Moses said, whom did I say will send me? Well, tell them, I am who I am sent you. Okay, thank you. Don't know that that helps, right? There's going to be an answer to what that looks like. And it's absolutely mind-blowing. And they actually get to learn what it means for Yahweh to be I am. But it's about his character. It's what we should be known for. And if you're into design theory, which I'm interested in, this is what stands. Every design choice is shaped by your character. Every design choice. Think about that. They're not just grey boxes. They're computers that people will sit in front of, and you want them to bring life to people as they use them. Right? Now, you can think of some advertising where they talk about that. They talk about their products, and what they want is that people who use them will be connected and they'll experience more of life. They don't realise how biblical that is, I would argue. So in his creativity, that's what God does. He's a creator. And you know, for me, God loves us doing this kind of stuff. That's what we do. I talked about that in the first session, not the second sermon, the first one. What is faith? Faith is the substance of things hoped for. So, right, the matter of the stuff that's hope and the evidence of things that are not yet seen. Isn't that design? Isn't that how an iPhone begins? Right? That's where that word faith comes from, folks. It's the language of design in the ancient world. Right? Seeing the world in a new way and bringing it into being. That's what the gospel does. Right? It's a design paradigm. How do we transform our world? That's what designers do. What was Marx's greatest complaint? Philosophy is not about just describing the world, it's about transforming it. That's the gospel. Talking to Chinese students just a couple of weeks ago and telling them, you know what, actually Karl Marx is a child of Christianity. Kind of amazed them. As well as telling them that actually Christianity is Eastern and not Western. They never heard that before either. But this is what we do, right? So when you're creating stuff and you're doing it in a way that brings life to people, you're doing exactly what God made you to do, right? You're doing that exactly. It's hard work sometimes, but isn't it great when it works? You go, wow, that's brilliant. And you think God's saying to you, that's really weird. I don't get that. Why are they doing that, right? No, he made you to do that. And he takes great pleasure when you do. Now, relational beings. Well, we know this. The Trinitarian God, right? Relational God. It's all about relationship. Our humanity is scripted in the grammar of our relationships. Our humanity is scripted in the grammar of our relationships. You want to destroy your humanity? Destroy your relationships. That'll be the end of you. And you can think of half a dozen movies from Hollywood to get that right every single time. That's what we're about. That's why the Bible talks about character and how you relate to our openness and transparency, being upfront with stuff. It's all the nurturing of relationship. If you get that wrong, we'll be in trouble. Male and female, slave, free, Jew, Gentile, some of the most radical words ever spoken in the ancient world, totally opposed to Plato's Republic, totally opposed. Every human being made in God's image. Try that tomorrow at work. When you see the janitor, recognize that they are exactly the same degree of God's image as the CEO driving in an Mercedes. Right? And don't ever make the mistake of thinking that because someone has a BMW, they're more important than the person who doesn't. Don't ever make that mistake. Do not betray God with that blasphemous judgment. If I'm speaking strongly about that, it's because we need to hear it. We get tempted into thinking that the whole time. God's not against BMWs. They're fine. I wish I had one. Actually, an Audi would be better, right? But when those things become tokens by which I actually denigrate another human being, I've crossed the line, folks. Right? And that whole Genesis, Exodus narrative now turns around and bites me on the nether regions. This is not what we do. One more time, there it is, there it works, right? So, our physical embodiment, we're not just thinkers, right? We're agents, we do stuff in the world, we're embodied, it's wonderful, right? It's integral to being human. That's why Jesus heals us, right? And our senses are so important. It's what it means to be, you can't be God's image without this. Now, some of you, if you kind of come up and talk to me, you realize that my left eye is damaged, right? It happened when I was younger. And it happened about the age when you begin to discover that girls are actually pretty amazing things. Instead of the yuck turns to woo-hoo, right? And you just kind of, you know, this absolutely gorgeous thing comes along. You just kind of fall into a complete heap. You don't know what to do with it. And, you know, your hormones are kind of rushing through. And you have no idea what to do surrounded by this amazing thing, right? And I have really clear memories of, you know, seeing a really kind of attractive girl and wanting to go talk to her. And I have the conversation. And then the moment comes when I know that she sees I'm damaged goods. And she doesn't want to let me know that she knows, but I know she knows, right? I'm 62, I can go back to those moments in a nanosecond, right? They shape us, they really do, right? That's why Jesus heals people. restoring our humanity because our bodies do impact how we see ourselves. Now, also have to say, I think our view of beauty has to be healed. I think we've got totally messed up on what it means actually to be beautiful in God's eyes. We've got to do some work on that. And church ought to be a safe place where people can come, and when they hear the gospel, what's also being healed is their notion of beauty and success and all of those things. That stuff gets healed as well. How we relate to others. Every human being made in God's image. Every act of injustice against another human being is an act of high treason against God. Hear that? Every time I think that someone else's race makes them less than I am, it's an act of high treason against God. Every time I cheat in my business dealings, that's an act of high treason against God. Every time I dissemble, every time I try to throw my weight around, why? Because every human being's made in God's image. It really does matter how we treat them. That's why most of Jesus' teaching in the end of Mark is about how you treat the least. That's the critical thing. And the prophets, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This is the law and the prophets, and now you know why. Right. Well, love of God and neighbor. No discrimination now on the basis of these things. Everyone's made in God's image. And finally, why this emphasis on humanity? Because we're the ones who act in the world. We're the ones who impact creation. The environmental crisis is not the problem caused by the water beetle. It's us. Right? We're the agents who act in the world. And it seems to me, because we've gone for this autonomy and we've abandoned Yahweh's character, all of creation suffers. But what God is about is restoring us into his image and through us to bring life to the world. Okay, you've been very, very patient. That's probably nearly close to an hour, isn't it? So let's break now. Is that a bit longer? I don't know. How long have I gone? I can't remember. Okay. I had an out-of-body experience just the last whatever it was. Okay, so why don't we take a break and then we'll come back and you can ask some questions.
We have two roving mics, so I'll have one here at the front and Ryan has one at the back. So if you'd like to ask Rick something, put up your hand and the nearest of us will come and find you and speak into the microphone. And make sure it's a question you're actually asking rather than making some sort of a statement.
I understand some of this stuff is quite controversial in some respects. I'd be really pleased to have a conversation where we go on quite an extent, but I don't think this is the right venue. So it's more about questions of clarification rather than rebuttals or something like that. Is that okay? But a question down here.
This morning you said that heaven comes down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what happens to the people that are now in heaven?
Yeah, this is a great question. What happens to people who die? And I just go to Paul and he says, to be absent from the body is to be... Actually, that's pretty good for me. Where that is, I don't really know. Is it 5,000 light years above the North Star or something? That's not really the kinds of... I don't think there's a geography to that. But, you know, to have died in the Lord is to be present with Jesus. So, I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, of course, because Paul talks about the dead in Christ will rise first. And then you start thinking, okay, hang on a minute. So they're all up there with Jesus, or they're there, wherever it is, because up for Australia is different from up in Athens, okay? And then you understand, I mean, you just realise they're trying to talk about a reality that transcends the geography we're used to, and that's okay. I just want to get bent out of shape about that, but I have thought, so they're kind of enjoying this, and then there's a five-minute warning bell, right? So back you go, into your graves, okay, we're all back in our graves, and you wait for the da-da-da, and up you come, right? And you look at that and you think, really? But you know that, no, they're trying to wrestle with something that's just so much bigger than they can ever really, because no one's actually had bona fide experience of this yet. So they're talking about something that is not clear. So I understand the hesitations, understand the questions. God doesn't seem too fussed about telling us about that stuff. I think he's much more concerned with, so Rick, how did you treat your neighbour this morning? Right? I think he's much more concerned about that. But, you know, I have to say to you, you know, both my parents, I will see them again. They're with Jesus. And I don't know, they might have actually, who knows? For them, their only conscious experience might have been of stepping from their deathbed, and the next thing they knew, they were in the resurrection, and there we all were around them. I mean, I just don't know. But, you know, you can be comforted. It's okay. They're with the Lord, and it's good. And he will remember them. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Bernard. Yeah.
So in the this architecture of the temple and the garden, we didn't invite in the serpent. How does the serpent fit into that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We didn't invite the serpent in. How does it fit into it? But you see, this is the interesting thing about the Bible. It's not really giving us some of these deep answers, like, for example, the problem of evil. And people have wrestled with this for a very long time. So the first thing to say is, don't think I have the answer. But here, yeah, sorry about that. One of the first of many great disappointments. but here's my take on it, just for what it's worth. In the Hebrew Bible, we're responsible for what we know. Right? So God's going to ask us about our relationships. What do we do in the realms that we can actually engage? But we're not responsible, in a sense, for what we don't know. And I think that's a gift. And I think that's partly what underlies Job, and Bernard can correct me if I need to be corrected on this. But, you know, Job asked God, so hang on, there's this really big issue, what's going on here? And God doesn't actually answer the question of the origin of moral evil. He says, just look around. Does this creation look like the work of a madman? And Job says, no, it's not. There's amazing stuff here. And then he says, I've spoken of things that are too big for me. I'm just going to close my eye. And it's not because God wants to keep secrets from us. I think if he told us about the nature of the origin of the problem of evil, right, or it's where it came from, we would be responsible for that knowledge. But we can't deal with it. Only God can deal with that, and he does it on the cross. And kind of Lewis captures that in the Narnia Tales with the deeper magic. It's his way of kind of talking about this stuff. So I think all the Genesis thing he's talking about, it's not really where the serpent came from. I really don't think it's to do with can serpents talk and what colour do the leaves of the tree of life turn in the fall. I don't think that's the issue. I think given the iconography of that, it's a real question about who you're going to choose to follow here. Yahweh and learn from me what it means to be human, or do you want to go the autonomous way of Pharaoh? Because they're really the only options. You end up going down one of those two paths. So, you know, the issue is not, I would think, where the serpent comes from, but are you going to listen to him? So it's a great question, can't really answer. But thank you. You're a scary bunch. It's great though, yeah. You can talk into that. I think it's working. Oh, not now. We have a dead microphone.
There we go. It's working now.
Resurrection life. See,
exactly. Okay. Given all you said this morning and just tonight, I'm curious how that colors the way you evangelize when you sit down next to someone who you've never met.
Yeah. I have one job, to bring the life of God to them. So, a couple of little stories, actually, if you don't mind. So I'm just learning this, right? And I'm, you know, I might be a professor, but I'm like a kid in diapers trying to learn what it means to do this. And across the road from Egypt used to be an old pizza shop. I was there when you were there. I don't know if you ever went there. And I used to be served by this woman who was in her 60s, right, or mid-50s. And you have to ask yourself, what young woman at 18 years of age plans to be serving pizzas in a pizza shop at 55? No, there's a story behind that, and it's probably not a happy one. So, I'm trying to just work out what this thing looks like. I'm just really embarrassed to say this. She's kind of like my project. I mean, how dehumanizing, but you know, it's going to be my learning space. So she comes to serve me, and I want to talk to her, and say, how are you doing? And I'm interested. And I wonder if she thought I was trying to pick her up or something. eventually we got used to chatting, and that was great. And I walk in and say hello to all the guys. The first thing I do before I ordered, how you doing, guys? And they'd all kind of laugh and talk, we just got to know one another. And so anyway, Christmas comes along, and I'm working late. Doing it at Region, went across and had a pizza. And so out comes the piece of paper that really reflects my spirituality. It's called the bill. And on that is one line that tells me the truth about myself. It's called the tip. Right? So I'm looking at this, I kind of give a nice little tip. And I just felt like the Holy Spirit said to me, aha, you know what time of year this is? And I'm thinking, oh no, I know where this is coming. Okay, this is Christmas. Yes, it is. And what happened to, I know, great, yes, it is the great undeserved gift. Oh, and what did you just write? Ah. Okay, cross it out a bit more and it's like, no. Now, see, here's the ridiculous thing. I wouldn't think twice about spending a couple hundred bucks on myself for this or that that I liked. But to give somebody a $20, $50, $60 tip, you'd think it was killing me. And you know why that happens? Because I'm an idolater and I love money more than people. That's the truth. Right? That's the truth. And I can sing hymns till the cows come home. But that's the moment when it really comes home to roost. I have a friend who owns a chain of restaurants in Canada. I've talked to him, he says, the day his servers hate most is Sunday. When Christians, pardon my French, you might want to lead it, full of piss and righteousness, sorry, but that's what it's like in their eyes, turn up and they grizzle about this, they grizzle about something else, and they tip like the devil. And these people can't stand the church. Because of the fact that when we turn up in their space, we don't look anything like the God of the Bible. Not you, but it's a problem that they deal with, right? So I'm looking at this thing and I think, oh my goodness, call the ambulance, right? This is worse than an amputation. So I kind of lift this and I just write underneath, God bless you, okay? And, Christmas comes and it's gone and come back after that and, of course, get to see her again. And she comes to serve me. She's kind of my server now, right? We chat and talk, we're friends. And just out of the blue, she said to me, I've started to read my Bible. We'd never talked about Jesus. My project was simply to try and bring the life of God to her, to treat her with dignity and respect that she deserved because she was made in God's image in spite of what she did. Right? It was the most amazing thing because I used to try and be the great white shark evangelist. I would lay in wait at universities for hapless first years, right? Invite them over a cup of coffee and then pounce, right? Right? Evangelism is Jaws. And, I demolish all of their arguments, right? And how pathetic. And I wonder why, when they're lying in this pool of blood on the floor, then I'd say, would you like to believe in Jesus? And no one ever did. Hello, anybody home? Right? Oh, boy. So, I'm just learning. And it was amazing. And I'm thinking, what do I say now? And I'll let you be the judge. I just said, Lord, help me. And I looked at her and I said, I always knew you were a wise woman. And sooner or later, you'd tumble to the truth. That's what and it's probably not your language, but it's mine, right? She started to cry. I started to cry. I didn't know. She went off and we never talked about that again. And it was just that moment. But God's got her email address. It's okay. He knows where she is. So the final part of that story is I was away on sabbatical, came back and they were closing down the area, redevelop it, and the place was closing down. I went across with a friend from England and we went to a little pizza place and I'll just tell you this because this is what the gospel does to great white sharks. I walked in and they're, Rick, haven't seen you for ages. Yeah, been away. How's it all doing? Good, good, good. And we're chatting away. And then, she comes up and says, how are things? Good. And then she turns to my friend and she says, I don't know how well you know this man, but we love him here. Every time he comes in, he brings light. Now, that is not me. That's the Holy Spirit at work, trying to bring life to people. And I can tell you a range of stories. One other little one, and then we'll finish. But I'm on the plane. I'd missed my flight. I was a bit cranky, full of grace and crankiness, right? Going to Seattle is going to be a really tight connection. I'm a bit of a grump. The guy sits next to me on this feeder liner, and I'm kind of... And he starts a conversation. My first impulse is, like, shut up. Let me just be grumpy here, right? I thought, no, I shouldn't do that. So I started to talk to him, and, you know, what do you do? And he says, well, I help people, you know, kind of emigrate into Canada and a bit about that kind of stuff. And he said, so what do you do? I'm thinking, what do I tell him, right? I teach theology. In Canada, that's kind of like the statement of death. That's it, right? It's kind of people... So I said, well, you know, I talk to people, you know, about Jesus, and he looks at me a bit, and I said, well, you know, but I think the problem is this, that Christians think knowing Jesus is about being good, and it's not. It's about bringing life to people. He said, really? I said, let me tell you a story. So I told him the story of the day laborer. You know, how this guy's got, I kind of embellish it a bit, he's got a 9-year-old daughter. She hasn't eaten for 2 days because he hasn't worked. Turns up, no one asks him, so he's a good dad. He's terrified. How do you face your daughter when she can't eat? Men can cope with a lot, but not feeding their families. No, that'll destroy you. Right? And he waits for in the middle of the day and no one asks him. And finally, at the end of the day, the guy says, what are you doing? Come and work for me. And all that guy's thinking about is how he can get to the bakery ahead of everyone else. He'll go without. That's what men can do. But at least he'll get some bread for his daughter. And it works. He's at the front of the line. And he sticks out his hand, and how much does he get? A full day's pay. I said to the guy, that's what God's like. That's what we're trying to tell people Jesus is like. And he looked at me and he said, but that's what I do. And I said, well, mate, you and Jesus ought to start talking. You get on fabulously. That's what it. And he said, really? And I said, yes, right? And I'll never forget it. I mean, he was also running late, and he dashed. And just before he disappeared off the plane, he turned around and gave me a big wave and a big smile and was gone. Now, I may never see him again, but God has his email address. That's the kind of stuff. Does that help? Yeah. Thank you. This is great stuff.
Hello. Since reading the book of Job, I've wondered, how would a church do if someone studied that as their Bible study session? You get an awful lot of conversations out of that.
It would.
So have you ever done
that? You should do that with Bernard. Ha ha. Thank you. Boy, did I just drop you in it. But this is the Brer Rabbit of Job, you understand, right? So, you know. Well, this is good. No questions. It's great. Oh, no. Okay. Not getting away that easy.
I think you made a comment in passing that Christianity is from the Asian point of view, not the Western point of
from
view.
East,
I wonder
yeah.
if you'd embellish on that a little bit, and because... maybe we have a different understanding in the valley here of what that distinction might be.
Yeah, well, I say it in the context of China, and there's a whole back history to China, right? I mean, the West has not treated China well. You know, they're usually surprised to learn that one of the descendants of William Wilberforce berated the English government for its role in the Opium Wars, and told the British government that God would judge England for what it was doing to Chinese people with opium. Right? They'd never heard that before. Right? So they think Christianity is Western. I say, actually, it begins in the Western part of Asia. Right? So geographically, this is not Western. And actually, it was in China before it made it to Northern Europe. Right? So I just do that as a way of saying to them, let's get this one straight. This is not the child of Athens. Even though sometimes the way we've done theology would make you think that. So that's really the point I'm after when I make that. We could spend more time talking about the difference between Athens and Jerusalem, if you liked, but you know that's going to take us a bit further afield. I have alluded to that at various moments in the presentation, part of the fire hydrant thing. But does that help you a little bit with the context of that? Thank you. Very gracious of you.
Since other people made idols of what they think God looks like or his images. Why did they worship them?
Yeah. This is a really interesting question. A lot of this stuff is lost to us because we just don't have the history behind it. But for some reason, the notion emerged that people wanted the presence of their gods. And how do you get the presence of their gods? Well, you do it by creating a physical object, because that's what presence is about. And you invite, as I said, the spirit of the god into that object. So they know they made the object, but they didn't make the spirit of the god that came into the object. So that they're aware of the difference. You can make hundreds of images and you never impact the deity like Amon-Re or Marduk. You can destroy those images. You're never going to affect who Marduk is or Amon-Re. They're simply means by which the god becomes present to you. So when you're worshipping the image, right, you're worshipping the god behind this. And they know that, right? And so there's a guy called Julian the Apostate. This is a bit later now, the 4th century. He realizes there's more going on with images, right? We're not just identifying them. But the point is, I think partly what Israel's going on about is not that these are just hunks of stone. To be God's image means you have to see. You have to hear. The senses, right? Absolutely critical to being God's image. How can you think this idol is God's image when it can't do any of that? In order for the god to function in the world, you have to be able to move around, right? So for the Hebrew people, one of the senses is the ability to move. We just think, hearing, sight. But no, speech is a sense for them, and also the ability to move around. So that's partly what the anti-idol mockery is about. I mean, you say these are the images of gods and they're enlivened, but they do none of the stuff that an image actually needs to do, to see, to hear, to speak, because that's the way we change the world. That's the way we bring life to it. Okay. And that just gets back to, this is not the Athenian way. They don't really care too much about the senses. What they care about are perfect ideas. That's why they never really develop science. Yeah. Anyway, thank you. Great question. Was it Jacob? Is that right? Yeah, good on you. Thanks, mate. Well done.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate on the notion of...
Sorry, where are you? Can you wave
your hand? I'm right here.
Oh, over there. Right, thank you. I hear the voice. I'm thinking...
It's God talking to you. No, I was just wondering if you can elaborate. You mentioned that we need healing from our notion of beauty.
Yeah.
You talked about the physical body.
Yeah, I think we do, actually. If we're not careful, we end up... I think many women know this. I mean, I know in Vancouver they know this. They look in the mirror and they just think, I don't live up to this image. And you've seen all this stuff about the... Even the fashion companies now are saying, no, we've got to get away from this perfect, what we present as the perfect image, that kind of denies even the model's humanity in the process. So I think it's that. I mean, I think it's learning to realize that, yeah, physicality matters. You don't just ignore the body. That's part of it. But I think learning to appreciate the benefits or the beauties in different kinds of bodies is part of it, right? Now, I think we need to take care of our bodies. I think we need to do that. But, whether that means becoming like the Greek gods. I mean, look at the statues of the Greek gods. They're all perfect, right? I find them terribly lifeless. I don't like Greek art. Just doesn't resonate with me at all. And none of them have hair on their chest. Come on, you're Greek. What are you talking about, right? But the gods don't have that. So, that kind of thing, I think, is a problem, right? We've somehow denied our humanity in all of this. And so, what's the balance between personal grooming and recognizing this is made in God's image? So how do I honor that without going to some extreme that actually ends up abusing the very image because I do something with the standards of grooming and dress that just humiliate people? I haven't really thought that through, but I think that'd be a really interesting thing for Christians to begin to think about. Right? Does that make any sense? Forgive me for this terribly sexist comment, but you can tell when a young woman's in love, she just shines, and it's a beautiful thing, right? You know that? You kind of ever seen that? It's like, oh my goodness, someone loves her. She's just shining. I think that's the kind of beauty that we're trying to look for. Does that help a little? Sorry, it's not a great answer, is it?
You said that the Greeks were after perfect ideas, and they, for that reason, they didn't develop science. What then develops science, and do we risk science being idle?
Yeah, I think we can. There's a couple of people who've argued this. Arthur Koestler wrote The Sleepwalkers back when, in the 60s or 70s or something. Wonderful book about Copernicus and these guys looking at the universe. And because they're still influenced by this perfect idea notion, they're having real trouble with accepting the planets don't move in a perfect sphere, but they move in an ellipse, right? And why do we have seven colours in the rainbow? Not because there's seven colours, but because that was believed to be, seven was the number, like the seven wandering stars. So you had to have seven colours in the rainbow. Is it really? Not because there's seven colours, actually. So, you kind of got these perfect ideas that stop people from seeing what's in front of them. And I mentioned that before. Of course, heavier objects fall faster than light ones. No one ever let go. The first guy to do it was a guy called John Philoponus in 529 AD, Christian theologian. He's the first one who said, as far as we know, you have to critique Plato and Aristotle just like you critique any human being. Astonishing thought. So because they're looking at these, for the perfect idea, they don't actually see what's going on in front of them. Now, science can become a god when you think that this is the answer to everything. And in a strange way, it kind of is, because the same approach you use for doing science is the same approach you use for getting to know Yahweh. You use your senses in both instances, and you think about what you see and experience. But it's when science says, well, there's only what I can see in terms of physical experiment, then I think it's got a problem, because it's denying history in one sense. And history is the realm of persons. Right? You know people by looking at their history, not by looking at their DNA map. So I think where science gets itself into trouble, where it says, well, we're only going to take this natural stuff, so-called, and that's going to be the sole explanation. I think, well, no, that's just... What do you do then with a resurrection story that you really can't explain unless it happened? Right? You've got to admit that somehow into your... So just to recap that, I think the reason why the Greeks never got it is because they kept on letting their perfect ideas get in the road instead of testing what they saw. Or instead of testing their theories. Right? So a piece of wood in water, right, from the edge of the water looks bent. You'll never learn what's going on if you simply sit in your deck chair and think about it. You might say, I can't trust my senses, but the only way you'll solve the problem is by trusting your senses, getting up and taking the wood out of the water and putting it back in again. Look at that, it's straight, now it's bent. Oh, what's going on here? Well, then you test and you use your senses. They never really did that. The danger is, if that's all you're doing, you think everything's about wood and water, you're not gonna have space for stuff you learn in history. And I think that's one of science's problems, right? It's kind of lost the human side, or it can lose the agency side in the world by simply looking at nature. And then I think it becomes an idolatry. Does that help a little bit? That's where I would go. But I'm convinced it's the gospel that says, pay attention, use your eyes. John says this, we saw, we touched, we handled, we heard. It's all senses stuff. You hear faith versus reason, ever heard that? Christianity is about faith, science is about reason. Ever heard that stuff? That's nonsense. When the disciples are walking with Jesus and he heals somebody, there's no faith, they're seeing it. When Moses is, he's out with the sheep, who knows what he's thinking, probably grizzling a bit. What am I doing in this stinking desert with these rotten sheep? Kick, right? And kind of looks out the side and there's this burning bush. Oh my goodness, I think I'll go take a little bow peep at this. Huh? There's no faith in this. That's experience. When the disciples are in the boat with Jesus and the mother of all storms comes along and he stands up and says, shut up, and it does. There's no faith in that. That's experience. Like, we saw this. That's what scientists do. No? that emphasis on paying attention to the world around you, and reason has always to be subject to what the senses tell you, right? That came from us, I think. All right. There's one over here, is that Jennifer? Yeah, okay, and then I think there's one over here too, so just hold on. Yeah, sorry, we'll get this one over here first, so that's okay. Thank you, yeah. Yeah. Hello, sir.
Hi. You just said that, or gave the examples of the disciples seeing something that Jesus done, healing somebody, quieting the storm.
Yeah.
Why didn't they follow up what they saw with
what
would come next?
I think it's like, this, I can't believe this. I mean, you're a Jewish person. As far as I understand, you're not expecting God to come among you in the form of a carpenter. Maybe a glory cloud descending on the tabernacle. Maybe this thing on Mount Sinai with thunder and lightning, you've had that. Maybe even Isaiah's vision, just the hem of his garment filling his temple, right? But from Galilee? Did you say, what? Nothing good comes from this place, right? And this is their turf. I mean, these are the sea dogs. What does a chippy know about that? Chippy is an Australian term for carpenter, right? But what does a carpenter know about the water, right? And then, of course, they've seen him heal people. But that's a different thing from standing up and saying to the sea, shut up, and it does. And I just think it pops all the circuits. They just don't know what to do with this. And it's just such a massive shift. I mean, many of you have read the Lord's Prayer, may your kingdom come, and you still sing about going to heaven. And then we say, why are the disciples so dense? Oh, really? You know, it's they're walking with Jesus on the road to Emmaus. Why do they not recognize him? Well, he's dead. They know that. He's dead. It just doesn't occur to them. Right? And then later on they say, but we knew it! We knew it! Yes, you did, right? Why couldn't you see it? Well, because wasn't expecting a resurrection of one person in the middle of time. No, you weren't. And that's why the story can't be invented. Right? So this is a great thing. This is what discipleship is about. It's about following Jesus. You think about it, but you know, got to listen to the voice of the Spirit because it blows where it will. And that's what God's into. He'll do some stunning stuff among you. Might even do it here, and it might upset some of you. Sorry about that, but it actually doesn't matter. It's what God does. So I think that's how I would explain that. You know, Bernard, who's now gone, cycles and, you know, constantly almost gets run over. In spite of the fact that his bike has flashing lights and bright yellow jackets, looks like this kind of movable Christmas tree, right? And people still say, I never saw you. What? But, you know, you just get fixated on the road and you just don't see stuff. How many of you are driven in a car and you realise, I don't even know what I did for the last 5 minutes? Don't own up to it. Too scary. But I think it's like that. I mean, you just, some ideas, it takes a while to get used to. But boy, when that idea hits, and it hits very early on, right? The New Testament, the only Christology you have is the astonishing idea that Jesus was somehow Yahweh among us. That is mind-blowing. That not only means a new creation for us, but it will end up meaning the whole world will now be made new because we see it in a very different light. So yeah, for me, the emergence of the modern world comes out of Israel's story and the resurrection. It wasn't just us who were made new. It was the whole creation was made new because we saw it in a different light. It had never changed. It had always been that. But our idolatries had blinded us. And the resurrection rips that apart. You're probably getting the idea that I think Jesus is pretty amazing. I do. I love him. I think he's absolutely mind-blowingly, astonishingly, extraordinary, incredible. He's as sharp. I'm getting into trouble saying this as three sticks. I mean, this guy knows his material. And he can put it in such simple ways. Little stories that just blow the world right open. He's incredible. You should never be ashamed of Jesus. The world's never seen the like of him. Jennifer, I think, was waiting patiently.
Hi, I just wanted...
It's good. Boom it out.
I just wanted to know if you were going to talk about Revelation and the end times.
Ah.
And what our world is going to, and if you have any
predictions. That's a great question, but probably not for tonight.
Okay.
Is that okay? That's a great question, and I really am dodging the load. that's a much larger question, and I think I'll leave that to Bernard. But do you think we should let that go through to the keeper, or take a swing at it, run the risk of being a strainer and get bowled out? What do you think? See, Bernard's the guy who's really talked about this, right? Does anyone have any questions? Sorry, Jennifer, that are more pertinent to the discussion. If not, then I'm very happy to talk about that. Otherwise, we can chat a bit later. Would that be all right? Would you mind?
Yes, that's okay.
It's very kind of you. Thank you so much. Would you like to? Thank you. Appreciate that. It's very kind of you. Phew, he says.
This morning you talked about how heaven is going to be coming to earth, basically,
I think so.
God coming down to us.
Yeah.
And I kind of got stuck because in Revelation 21 it says, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea."
Yeah.
And then further on it talks about how there will not be any need for the sun or the moon because God will be our sun, and there's not going to be any nighttime.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll only be daytime. So could you...
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, genre is the critical question. Remember we talked about genre? Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, The Simpsons, all that kind of stuff. The book of Revelation is a really unusual genre that was quite common for three or four centuries, but hasn't been used for a very long time. And as one scholar's commented, few books in the New Testament have been so assiduously studied and with such generally disastrous results as the book of Revelation, because people are not aware what to do with the imagery. We're far more comfortable with something like Romans. And in Romans, Paul says, creation waits for its redemption. Now, this is Romans, Presbyterian background. This is good, solid stuff. So whatever we do with the other material, it can't contradict the kind of stuff that's explained in fairly straightforward terms. Creation's waiting for its redemption. So we talk about the old heavens and the old earth have passed away. There's a new heaven and a new earth. Right? Now, this is this interesting book, Revelation, with beasties and dragons and obviously too much anchovies on his pizza. That's the problem, right? All that kind of stuff. So, but where have you seen passing away, old is gone, new has come? Have you seen that language anywhere else in the New Testament that's in literature that you're more comfortable with? If anyone is in, they are a, what has the... has gone and the new has come. That's describing you. Were you suddenly burnt up and destroyed and eradicated? No, right? So what I would do, and it's a great question, what I would do is read that language in the light of this, that old heavens and old earth going away does not necessarily mean destruction. It could simply be the kind of language you have to use because the transformation is so extraordinary. It is the beginning of a whole new world. Pardon me for the illustration. Any fans of Shakespeare in love? Right? Yeah, come on, you guys. You love it. Put your hands up, right? Your wife will love you for admitting it, right? Now, you know the story, right? When the two of them kind of, he crawls up through the bedroom window and, you know, the stuff happens as God intended it to. Probably not according to the manner he intended, but it happens. And the nurse comes in the next morning and says, it's a new day. And she says, oh no, it's a new world, right? And she's right, right? That this, it's an amazing thing when this happens. But the only way to describe that, right? That experience in that kind of profound union between a male and a woman, for her, this is a new world. You can't. It's the only way to describe this thing. So I'd read a lot of that elevated language in a way of saying, you know, hey, you think you've had coffee? Baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. I think that's the Bible's way of saying it. Or Paul says this, it hasn't even entered into our minds what extraordinary things God has for us. There may well be the most amazing starships on the shores of Sagittarius in the world to come. I mean, who knows? So that's how I'd respond to that one. Now, you know, there's no more sea. Again, you've got to remember, this is a city that's 1,500 miles, that we recognize the symbolism. And again, Bernard, you know, he's taught Revelation, so he could tell you this probably better than I could. But the sea is a symbol of threat, right? So if you're a sailor like I am, don't panic. I think there probably will be oceans, but it's the idea of the sea being the threat. And of course, darkness, you know, and the sun and moon and stars, what are they? They're the things that govern the seasons. That's what Genesis tells you. But actually, I would read this and be some debate. But in Christ, we're no longer determined by those things. Now God is our light. He's the one who determines our times and seasons. That's how I would read that, right? Which is one of the reasons why I think, you know, I was talking to Bernard about this, Israel's history is full of feasts that people remember. Tabernacles, right? Passover, Sabbath. And when the New Testament, when Jesus does his thing, that all goes. The priesthood goes, the temple building goes, all that stuff is gone, and it's simply the Lord's Supper as often as you will. And no feasts. What does that mean? I think what it's saying is Jesus now stands at the center, not the times and seasons. We are eschatological people. Every day is Christmas for us. Every day is Easter for us. Every day is Shabbat for us. Every day is Tabernacles for us. Right? We're eschatological people. We are no longer determined by some calendar. That's how I would read that language. So, and you understand people will debate that. Probably people will debate most of what I say. So, you know, just... That's where I would go on that. That's what John's about. Jesus fulfills all these feasts. That's why we don't keep them. And this might be a little more, you know, I'm a little worried about church calendars. A little worried. Because I think they drag us back away from being eschatological people into something that's marked by the passage of time. We are marked not by the passage of time, but by Jesus. And the eschatological gift of the Spirit. I have some friends who are very keen on the Eucharist. You've got to be really careful about that. The Eucharist doesn't make the church. The Spirit of Jesus does. And that Spirit is not bound by meals or seasons or special days or months or, you know, enjoy the meal, but it's not the meal that makes you. It's the Spirit that enables you to celebrate the meal as you ought to. And that's what John's on about. When he does his thing on the meal, doesn't even mention the words of institution. Not that they don't matter, but the two things that matter to him are, if we don't know how to wash one another's feet, no amount of having a meal is going to do us any good whatsoever. And secondly, the only way that can happen is through the indwelling of the Paraclete. Well, that's no surprise to you. What enables the image to come alive? Indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Why does Jesus cast unclean spirits out? Because he's preparing you for something. Right? What does Peter bear witness to? Right? This is Peter, the rock upon whom I build my church. What does he bear witness to? The coming of the Spirit on Jews and Gentiles. That's the great prophetic hope. That's what this is about. God is giving you his Spirit, so not only do you know what God looks like, you can actually start to look like him. And it's not by trying harder. They're fruits of the Spirit. Not about self-discipline per se. That's not us. That's Aristotle. That's not us. We pray daily to be filled with the Spirit because that's what changes us. There is room for, you know, responding to that, but that's the difference in focus, I think. Up there, question? Yeah. Is that okay? I don't know. Well, it's a longish kind of rambling answer, but that's me. Sorry. Isn't it? Sorry, hon. Yeah. Ah, hi, sir. How you doing?
Fine. So this may be a question that
is not sort of...
Sure.
But I'm curious about your journey to this view, because it's like mind-blowing and very different than anything that I've ever heard before.
I have a little hat with a spinner on it. I should wear that. It really was... 8 years old, I was drawing aeroplanes on the floor of our little church that we met in a YMCA building, and just been drawing all night. And then the altar call was given, and I just knew God was calling me. And I said to Dad, I've got to go forward. He said, what are you talking about? You've been drawing planes all night. You know, I've got to go forward. Pull on the trouser leg, right? And he said, okay. I still remember the song. Right? Tears come to the surface very quickly on this. Follow. I will follow Jesus. I will follow Jesus anywhere, everywhere. I will follow him. That just happened, right? Then being in a Pentecostal church, age of 10, kind of had this encounter with the Holy Spirit. Saw Canada and China, two places I'm involved in, 10 years old. 50 years later, here I am working in both these places, right? So had all of that experience stuff, right? Seen a lot of bogus stuff, of course, seen some real stuff. But the real issue was, I loved aircraft. What did that have to do with Sunday morning? That was the issue. And the journey kind of grew out of that. God's given me a mind. How do I make sense of this? So I went to, did engineering, right? Discovered it was all about math. What? I thought it was poetry in motion. Okay. I knew I'd married the right lass, and we were standing at an air show in England, Mildon Hall, and an old B-17 clawed its way into the sky, and Katie said, that's beautiful. Oh, hun! Yoo-hoo! I'm learning to think about, dealing with issues and questions in engineering, and I'm starting to think, well, can I do that with the Bible? And so then I went to university to do art history, philosophy, and sociology, and thought, I can't explain this stuff on the basis of philosophy. So I thought I actually rejected it all. Right? And then what that actually led me to a few months later was, hang on, I know I've been in prayer meetings that are better than some of the parties I go to. Right? So I tried this stuff. Oh, yeah, me too. No. And I just thought, this is pathetic. I've been in 3-hour prayer meetings that felt like 15 minutes, just the sense of God's presence. What am I doing? And I came back purely on the basis of experience. I looked at the people around me at university, and with all their philosophy, their lives were a wreck. This can't be the way. Remember saying to a prof, I hear all of that, but you still can't explain to me why a glass of red wine tastes so good. Right? You can't explain to me why I love Matisse. Right? There's got to be more to this than simply some kind of philosophical explanation. There's a whole nother part of it. Right? And that kind of then opened up the door to thinking about history and human experience and, then what's the Bible talking about and the different categories. That's kind of a very short summation of the journey. And then it's just trying to learn what the Bible was saying, realizing all the presuppositions we keep bringing to this. And you've got to have them. You can't be human without them. But are they the right ones? And one of the things they teach you in Bible interpretation is you have to be aware of the assumptions you're bringing. Are they the correct ones? You've got to be self-critical. Well, I'd learned about that with art history and perspective, all that kind of stuff. So it was making sense. And well, that led me to, what's going on in Genesis? It wasn't written to me. What were people thinking in that world? And then, for me, the stuff this morning, I just find that mind-blowing. It's the most exciting stuff. It's not, after all, about 24 hours. It's much, much bigger than that, and it's world-transforming. So that Marxist philosopher that I mentioned in the second sermon that I'm flying down to Dallas, sitting next to, and, we're talking about what we do, and he says, so what do you do? I'm thinking, okay, how do I get this conversation and keep it on the road? Oh, I teach ancient Near Eastern history. Oh, really? Well, yeah. And we talked about, there's something really interesting. Israel has a temple, but unlike any other nation, it has no idol in that temple. Really? We're just talking about this as history and culture. Then I explained that's where Christian values, Christian morality, character comes from. We treat people like we do because they're all made in God's image. And I'll never forget it. Right? He turned to his wife and said, hon, we need to start going back to church. Right? This is life-giving stuff. So that's kind of my journey into all of this. And we can, if I had more time, I could talk about it in more kind of academic terms if you wanted, but just trying to make sense of this. Does that help a little bit? I don't know. Yeah, invite me out to the pub. I mean, invite me out to the coffee shop. We'll have a great chat. We're done? We're done.
Well, I think that note of
thank you very much.
Testimony is a great place to end.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Rick, and I encourage you to come back tomorrow night, and Rick will move on to the next stage of the story. It's what is Israel all about? There's a saying, how odd of God to choose the Jews. Why did he choose Israel? What were his intentions for Israel? And Rick will tackle that. So come back tomorrow night at 7 o'clock for another stimulating evening. And thank you again, Rick.